General Menezes, Reel 2. We were talking about your time when you'd gone to the officers' training school at Bangalore in 42-43, and we were discussing the nature of the way you were treated. In this incident where a British NCO had upset... A British officer, sorry, had upset some of the more educated Indian cadets. Not in your platoon. How was that resolved?
Not in my company.
Not in your company. How was that resolved?
Well, the commandant decided to send them all home. Brigadier Gilbert was the commandant. He decided to send them all home. He discharged them because legally we were all subject to military law. But by that time, Field Marshal Auchinleck had come. So a couple of months later, they were all ordered back to cadet training. So they eventually, the ones who did agree to come back, not all, some of them felt they were still insulted or humiliated, so they didn't come back. So the ones who did come back were then commissioned about 2 months after us, some of them coming to my own regiment.
Now, what did you feel about your training course?
I think it was good in what was called Agram Plain at that particular point of time. There was no doubt it was tough. The assault or obstacle courses were physically rather taxing, then the long route marches, then these outdoor exercises where we had to dig and simulate actual operations. So I would say that training that was now being done was of a high standard as a result of a committee having been appointed after the reverses in Burma and the Arakan. So they had recommended that we Indian cadets do 8 months training instead of 6 months, so that was now being implemented. They had emphasized more outdoor exercises rather than the usual parade ground spit and polish. So from that point of view, the Indian Army had woken up to the reverses of Burma 1942 and the Arakan of the winter 1942-43.
Now what about the mess life? Can you describe what that was like, you know, in the officers' mess or the cadets' mess?
In the cadets' mess, both were, whether at Lahore or Bangalore, they were run by contractors. So the food was substantial. It was, after all, he got the rations from the supply, Indian Supply Service Corps, and he fed us. The only difference in Bangalore to Lahore was that because there was a British-owned brewery called United Brewery in Bangalore, there used to be a barrel of draft beer in every refectory, for which we paid, of course. But nevertheless, I was never fond of alcohol, but nevertheless, it was a facility that was there. And
was the food Indian style at Lahore and Bangalore, or European, or what style?
In both places, it was Indian style. The majority meals were Indian. The odd meal, on account of the British cadets, was, shall we say, European. But otherwise, by and large, the majority of the meals were Indian. Of course, breakfast was, shall we say, British from that point of view.
So what take me through, what sort of food would you get for breakfast? That would be...
Well, breakfast we would get fried eggs and potato fingers or whatever.
Lunch?
Lunch we would get curry. We would by and large get curry and rice. But my problem was that I was inclined towards vegetarianism. And you couldn't get much vegetarian food out of these contractors because it became more difficult for them to cook.
Was vegetarianism rare or common then? Were many people vegetarians?
No, the vegetarians were the minority in the sense that the British did favour what were called the martial classes, and they gave them the mistaken designation of martial races later, which is, from the ethnic point of view, a total misnomer. I mean, you can't say a Sikh. One moment you call him a martial class, and then you say he's a martial race, because that is what some of them are trying to say, that they are a separate race.
We'll perhaps come back to that later. But so it was fairly rare. What had made you a vegetarian? Was it the family tradition, or was it just your personal conviction, or was it, did you just feel it was more healthy?
No, I mean, I was not brought up as a vegetarian, either at home or in boarding school. But I didn't particularly like the way chickens were slaughtered, shall we say, with some of them running around headless. I mean, that kind of thing was not...
So it was by personal conviction. Did you have to compromise in the army then? I mean, sort of when you were a cadet, did you have to compromise?
Well, we had to compromise in the sense that I was averse to beef, shall we say, again by choice. The Hindus do consider the cow as sacred, but that is, shall we say, a fact of life. It's a way of life, that the cow is the source of all life in the sense of the milk, and therefore not to be slaughtered.
What about other meats? Would you eat them?
Well, I would eat mutton, but again progressively over a period of time. I did try to insist on vegetarian diet, but the way things were under the British, you would end up with potato cutlets for breakfast, potato cutlets for lunch, and potato cutlets for dinner. That is, I'm the cooks. I had not been trained to do anything vegetarian.
Now, what about your living conditions at Bangalore? What sort of accommodation?
Well, at Lahore, Bangalore.
Either.
We were given rooms. We were given rooms, and there were another cadet. So two of us with one civilian manservant or male servant to look after us, who would polish
it
out.
Was it comfortable accommodation then?
Yes, it was comfortable accommodation. It was a comfortable accommodation. The toilet or bathroom had to be communal, but that there was no alternative to, because they were essentially barracks that had been partitioned into rooms. I mean, long barracks or dormitories which had been partitioned into rooms.
And what about the social side of the officer's mess, or the cadet mess? Were they introducing you to some of the traditions of the British Army or Indian Army mess?
No, there were no traditions, except that they sort of ensured that you didn't eat with your hands, but that you ate with a knife and fork. But otherwise, there were no traditions as such.
You didn't have mess guest nights and things like that?
Not in the officers' training school.
Anything else happened during your training, or any stories you have that might illuminate your life there? Because you were there till May, I think.
May 43. Passed out in May. We were allowed, whether in Lahore or in Bangalore, to go out at weekends to the cinema, and if you wanted to go to a hotel or restaurant from that point of view. So when we were cadets at Lahore, we did go to the various restaurants, that some of them would have cabarets, all Western cabarets, and same thing in Bangalore. So the social life was limited to the extent of the money that you had.
Now, can I ask a little about your religion? You were Hindu, were you? Or?
No, I was brought up as a Roman Catholic, but my ancestors had been Hindus who had fled from Kashmir. We were Saraswat Brahmins who had fled from Kashmir on account of the numerous Muslim invasions in the north. I mean, people like Mohammad Ghori had invaded India. He was an Afghan raider. He invaded India 11 times in 7 years, shall we say. So from that point of view, eventually we fled southwards. But then, having settled down there in Goa, then you find the Portuguese arriving, and therefore eventually got converted by devices like beef being thrown into wells and things like that.
So you were a Roman Catholic, did you?
I was baptized as a Roman Catholic, brought up as a Roman Catholic, and I'm still a Roman Catholic.
Now, so what happened after you were commissioned in May 1943, I presume?
In May 1943, we were offered a choice of three regiments, and I got my third choice.
What were your first two choices and why?
My first choice was for a regiment called the Rajput Regiment.
Why that one?
Because I had a maternal uncle by marriage who was in the Rajput Regiment. He was pre-war from the Indian Military Academy. But I didn't get that. And my second choice was Rajputana Rifles. That was because their center was in Delhi. And at that particular point of time, my maternal uncle's family was in Delhi. I'd been brought up.
That's where your mother was as well?
But no, by that time we had moved to Agra. You see, we had been in Delhi. We had moved to Agra on account of my education. My sister also was educated at St. John's. So yes, out of sentimental reasons, the Rajputana Rifles, because the regimental center or depot was in Delhi. And the third choice was Bombay Grenadiers. That was under the mistaken impression that they would have some association with Bombay, the place of my birth. But in the event, like the French, I realized that the British were perfidious and retained designations like Bombay Grenadiers for regiments that had no association with Bombay any longer.
So where were they when you went in?
I went to a place called Nasirabad in what is now Rajasthan, near Ajmer. It was a cantonment that had been set up by the General Ochterlony, who had 13 wives.
And what was the situation when you were arriving as the most junior of subalterns, I presume?
Yes, we arrived. There were others from my officers' training school with me. There were four others, so five of us arrived. And the adjutant at that time, in May 43, was a Captain Emerson, Patrick Emerson. And he's remained a friend of mine ever since. So we talk and meet every day over here while I'm here. So I've known him for over 60 years now. He's in his 85th year and I'm in my 81st.
And Patrick Emerson was the...
Adjutant.
And what was he like then, I mean, as a man? Because we might interview him. What was Patrick Emerson like?
He's now the secretary of the Indian Army Association here.
But what was he like then?
He's a very good man. He's a very good man, but he had what is called, you may say, a chip on his shoulder, not against Indians, but against his superiors. And so you could call him Mr. Aginnett from the point of view of the British, but insofar as we were concerned, he was Mr. Aginnett.
And what about, could you tell us what the setup was at Nasirabad? Was this the depot?
Yes, this is what originally in East India Company days was called the depot, but the Indian Army having become bigger, you had first the designation training center, and then once you had expanded further, the term regimental center was introduced in the Indian Army of 1943.
So this was a
regimental center. I mean, in the old days it had been called the regimental depot, but that was deemed, shall we say, rather static. So you had full terminology would be a regimental training center.
Now, you arrived as a new subaltern. How did they treat you? How did they make you welcome and take you into the regiment?
Well, they treated us well. We had to share a bungalow with other subalterns, shall we say.
What were the bungalows like? Because people always talk about the bungalows that you get. What could you describe them?
The bungalows, by and large, were built for British officers in these cantonments, and there would be a three-bedroom affairs with a sitting room and a dining room. So we would be farmed out to these bungalows because we did not have so many married officers in these regiments. because either their wives were in Britain or they were bachelors. We had a few married officers, but the number of bungalows available for bachelors was more than it is today.
So these bungalows were pretty comfortable from the sound of it?
Yes, there was huge sprawling sprawling houses with gardens and all that.
And how many how many subalterns would be in each one?
So by and large, it was about three.
What bedroom each, then?
Bedroom each. We didn't have to share a bedroom, but we had to pay towards the gardener, pay towards the manservant, and that kind of thing.
Can you talk to me a little about the servants? What would the servants do for you, and what sort of status
did
they have?
Well, we were looked after hand and foot, in the sense that all our creature comforts were taken care of except food. So we bicycled to the officer's mess to have our meals or to go to the training area. But otherwise, we moved around in bicycles. And you had in these bungalows, you'd have a gardener to maintain the garden. You'd have a manservant to look after all of us. You'd have a sweeper to clean the place. And you'd have a washerman to wash the clothes and iron them, living in the same thing. But we all had to contribute. They were not paid for by the state as such. Whereas when we were cadets, the manservant was paid for by the state.
And how did you treat them? I mean, did you treat them well, or was it a formal relationship?
Well, we treated them well. When we look back, I mean, our pay as subaltern was limited, so therefore, the amount that we paid to these servants in these bungalows was not considerable. And now, when you look at it, you pay the servant 30 rupees, shall we say? I mean, in those days, it was enough for him to keep body and soul together of his wife and children. But today, it'd be frowned upon. 30 rupees has no meaning. But by and large, you see that class of servant no longer exists in India.
Now, what about...
To this day, when I talk to... they're all dead now, and I used to talk to my retired commanding officers here, they all used to remember their servants more than anything else in India.
Now, what about the training? It looks to me like you're on a battle. I can't read the other thing. You're on courses anyway, from the looks of it.
No, so when I arrived and I reported to Captain Emerson at that particular point of time, the news had just come in. A Lieutenant B.F. Miskin of my regiment had been killed on an experimental battle course. Now, this experimental battle course had been started with Royal Marine Commandos on account of the so-called Indian Army's failure in Burma and the Arakan. So the first experimental battle course Lieutenant Miskin had been sent on, but he had been killed on the course because they were allowed a certain percentage of casualties. And they brought the establishment out from one of these commando schools over here. So therefore, somebody from the regiment had to be sent to the next course, and I was sent. So to this day, I always pull now Lieutenant Colonel Emerson's leg that he deliberately sent me to my death, knowing that Miskin had been killed, and when there was choice of so many other subalterns in my regiment. But in a way, I'm grateful to him because it was a foundation of my military career.
Well, in that case, it's very important to us as well. Can you tell us what you did on this battle course, what it was that was experimental, and of course, what it was that was dangerous?
It was experimental in the sense that they were trying to work out what kind of syllabus they should have for Indian conditions and for Indian officers. Of course, there were British officers also, some of them lieutenant colonels. But the point is, everything was with live ammunition. And so you started off first thing in the morning, and you fired your weapon, or you were fired at all the time that you were out, and you came back dead tired at night. So it was both a toughening up experience as well as a realistic operational experience.
But what would you actually be doing on the exercise? You see what I mean? What I mean, you go.
They were trying to introduce what were called battle drills. So that is, if you were fired at, you took the ground, attacked, and all that, and you kept on doing the same thing, these battle drills, because they were producing the future handbook for the for the battle drills for the Indian Army at platoon level. So we were for 3 weeks. We were kept busy right through, not a day's rest or an hour's rest, carrying out these 150-mile marches and things like that. So 50 miles a day.
And you feel this was the foundation of
I personally feel it was the foundation of my any professionalism that I acquired. Not that the cadet officers' training schools were unprofessional, but they were still more gentlemanly compared to this battle school. Later, this battle school was then moved. We were the last experimental course. We were next door to the Chindits, where Wingate was training his, in the same forest. We were next door. And this school was then moved to South India to get them out of this Chindit training area, and became the Jungle Warfare School.
And the danger, of course, came in because it was live ammunition. So although they weren't aiming at you, there was only a certain
They were not aiming directly at you, but they were aiming over your head.
So accidents could happen.
Yes.
And that's what had happened to Mishkin.
Mishkin in the, it was so-called river crossing assault. His particular boat, either the people panicked or whatever, and it toppled over. It capsized, and he was drowned.
Now, you don't seem to have been at Nasirabad that long.
I didn't stay very long.
You were just on this course, and then.
Then I did well on this course, recommended to be an instructor, but nevertheless we had a division that had been, shall we say, 14 Indian Division, which had suffered a reverse in the Arakan. It was then grounded and made into a Jungle Warfare Training Division. And I was sent on the... I was sent as a company commander, out-of-turn promotion to captain.
Now, this was in November 1943, so you'd been at the other one from sort of June 43 to October 43.
I was not there all the time, and I also did a company weapons course apart from the battle course.
Oh, well, should we talk about that? What were you doing on that before we go on?
That was, we did all what were called company weapons, like your light machine, gun, your grenade launcher, your 2-inch mortar, all the weapons that you would have in your company, we were trained on. We fired them in battle conditions.
So you were training how to fire them. Were you also training in the tactical employment of them? So, you know, the method of applying.
Yes, because that was conjoined with the battle course. Because in the battle course we were carrying these weapons, and therefore we employed them tactically.
So you were promoted to acting captain
in November 43,
and sent to the 14th
Bombay Grenadiers. This was in this Jungle Warfare Training Division. The regiment was the 4th Bombay Grenadiers, and anything that you raised, a part of it was the 1st Fort would be a regular battalion, 2nd Fort would be a regular battalion. So 14th Fort was raised specially for this purpose.
And whereabouts were they? They
were in the forests of what was then called Central Provinces, at a place called Chindwara.
Now, how do you spell that?
Chindwara, Chindwara.
And that's where that was their base. That's where the Jungle Warfare Center.
No, that was where the divisional headquarters was outside Chindwara. That was the railway station. But we were miles out in.
So you're just in that area.
In that area, we were in what were called jungle camps, scattered. The whole division was out there scattered.
Tell me first what you thought of 14th Fourth. You know, when you joined them, this is your first battalion that you were joining.
Yes, this is the first battalion.
I know it's a training battalion, but
a jungle warfare training battalion.
What did you think of the setup of the 14th Fourth?
Well, I mean, insofar as that was concerned, our commanding officer was very a great gentleman, a very noble person. And but
what was his name? Do you remember?
A.J.L. Hughes.
A.J.
A.J.L. A.J.L. Hughes.
Hughes.
Now he had a remarkable career. He was a conscript of World War I, who then was in the Royal Army Service Corps as a driver, to which he had risen to the rank of corporal when the Royal Flying Corps was raised. He then opted to become a pilot, a sergeant pilot, and so therefore was a sergeant pilot in the then Royal Flying Corps. And thereafter, when he applied for a commission in the Indian Army, he went to Sandhurst and came out in the regiment.
And at this point he was the colonel of the regiment?
He was the lieutenant colonel commanding it. But then the...
And what was he like as a colonel? What were his qualities or problems?
He was a very, very kind man, very gracious man. I mean, he was a remarkable Englishman. You could call him noble if you would like, but of course he was Welsh, so you can't say that he was English. But nevertheless, he was very a noble person. We all held him in high regard. And
did he know his stuff? Was he himself an expert in jungle training, or was he really an administrator?
No, he was more an administrator in view of his background that I've given you. By circumstance of the regiment, he was the senior most person and was then promoted. He had been the second in command of the regimental centre as a major.
Were there any other officers, that British or Indian officers of the 14th, that strike come to mind before we go on to what you actually did?
Well, the only one surviving was a great friend of mine with whom I shared a tent in this 14th Fort, R.A.K. Wright.
R.A.K. Wright.
Right.
Was he another captain?
He was a captain. He was quartermaster. And he now a Queen's QC over here, but he's retired, Lincoln's Inn. So I meet him every now and then.
What was Wright like?
A thorough gentleman, but of course he'd been brought up in Kenya and educated in South Africa. So he didn't have the hang-ups of the public schools over here in many ways. But nevertheless, the British officers, by and large, were good in the sense. But the second in command was a gentleman called Major Hullock.
Hullock.
Hullock. But it was a bit of a tragedy because he'd come from another regiment where his commanding officer had gone off with his wife, you see. And there, from that observation or experience, I then realized that the British had longer knives for each other than for the enemy. And so Lieutenant Colonel Cumming, his former CO, had gone off with his second command's wife. But in terms of the situation in the Indian Army, that was frowned upon. So they did everything to keep Hullock and to keep Mrs. Hullock and Lieutenant Colonel Cumming, shall we say, apart. And that is a separate chapter which I'll come to later when the British court-martialed Lieutenant Colonel Cumming.
How did the British officers generally treat you? I mean, did they treat you as an equal, rank for rank, so to speak, or was there any expression of prejudice that you were aware of?
No, I was personally not aware of any prejudice because, I mean, I don't wish to carp in any way. But possibly, I was possibly more efficient than most of them. So from that point of view, they could not point their finger at me, because if any, these courses of instruction that I had been sent on, I had done better than they had. But nevertheless, they did not all accept that Indian officers were more efficient. But the point nevertheless arises that Indian officers had better command of their troops, as Philip Mason puts it, I mean, of their fellow Indians, than the British. The British had to sort of assemble.